From listener-supported KTOO, welcome to Juno Afternoon. We are back after our hiatus. We're broadcasting live from the homelands of the Occoquan and on demand as a podcast. It's Wednesday, July 16th, 2025. I'm your host, Boston Christopher. Gunath Cheesh, Hawa Tuk Sunusum, Salamat. Thank you for joining the conversation. You can also join us on our live stream for a behind-the-scenes look in the studio and see what's going on in here. You can join us on YouTube at ktoo.org/JPMLive or on KTOO's Facebook or Instagram pages. Today, we talk with weaver Lily Hope about her commissioned robe from the Crystal Bridges Museum in Arkansas. Lily and her colleagues will be recording a panel discussion today as well downstairs here at KTOO that you can be a part of. You can come and see what's going on. We welcome the news team in for a look at Thursday, July 17th's upcoming community barbecue. That's tomorrow. It's also a public safety conversation regarding the glacial outburst floods in Mendenhall Valley. And KTOO's Clarice Larson shares details on the candidate filing period opening this week here in Juneau. There will be 6 municipal seats available this year. We'll find out who's running and what you need to do if you're interested in learning more. Those conversations coming up this hour on Juno Afternoon.
Hansen grass, ka eat with the shu yi, we kashuk a yi tin. Jin kat ka ke jin ta kanakaya ha ani kak, gunish cheesh.
Support for Juno Afternoon comes from Alaska Airlines Club 49. Membership information available at club49hub.com.
You are listening to KTOO's Tlingit Word of the Week. This week's word comes from Kehinak John Martin. And the word this week is ch'uk.
Ch'uk.
That means coho or silver salmon. And here's a sentence.
Yakdatakhea ch'ukhoziti.
It was from Yakutat that the coho were born. Let's hear it again.
Ch'uk.
Coho or silver salmon. Gunesh Cheesh to Chune Lance Twitchell, Gold Belt Heritage Foundation, and the University of Alaska Southeast for this audio.
Kehinak John Martin was Dakdain Tan and a child of a Kagwantan man. He is from the Hunakawu, the people of Huna, and was a contributing elder and speaker at many language immersion gatherings in Glacier Bay, Yakutat, and Juneau. He attended boarding school in Shkakwe, Skagway, and attended Gonzaga University.
Tune in next week for another Tlingit Word of the Week from KTOO.
You are listening to community-supported Juno Afternoon on KTOO at 104.3 Juno, 91.7 Juno Auk Bay, and online at KTOO. You can also join us on our live stream behind the scenes in the studio here on KTOO's YouTube, Facebook, and Instagram pages. I'm your host, Boston Christopher. Lily Hope has, over the last many years, become a Juno weaving icon. She learned the craft from two legends of the field, one of them being her mother, and now has taken on the task of continuing to hand down this traditional craft to new generations. She also continues her own work with commissions and other projects, and many of you may be wearing earrings of hers as we speak. And tonight at 6 p.m., Lily and her collaborators are having a panel discussion entitled Weaving Sovereignty and Community, which will discuss her commission of a new full-size Chilkat robe from the Crystal Bridges Museum of American Art in Arkansas. And as always, it's an honor to welcome storyteller, weaver, mother of five, and oh, so much more, Lily Hope to the studio. Gunath Chi, Shatye Adi, thank you so much for all of you joining us. We'll get to the introductions of everyone else here. But Wasiati, Lily, how are you?
Oh, I'm doing great. Thanks for having me, Boston.
Excellent. You're getting ready for this cool workshop tonight, and that's going to be fun.
I'm a chill cat right now.
You're a chill cat. Would you do the honors of telling us who else is joining us here in the studio this afternoon?
We have Jordan Poorman Cocker, who is the curator of Indigenous art at the Crystal Bridges Museum of American Art. She is Kiowa and Tongan. And we have Sydney Akagi, who has been working with me for the past few years. She quit her job because of me. She's a full-time weaver. And Sydney
Wait,
Akagi,
what? Really?
What? Real,
we're going to have to. We'll get to that, yeah.
But Sydney Akagi is a Tlingit artist and Japanese. Mm-hmm. Okay. Her father is a postman, but she is a weaver. And happy to be all here together. We're three of the four that will be speaking tonight at 6 p.m. here at KTOO Studios downtown. Downstairs? Downstairs.
It is downstairs and downtown.
It is, yeah, both things.
Both. It's both. Yes. It's awesome.
6 p.m. Yeah. Going live, recorded audience. We'd love for you to be here.
So you're going to record this. It won't be streaming live, but you're going to record it. But you can also be part of the audience. So get down here at 6 o'clock today downstairs here at KTOO. And then that's going to be played next week sometime. Is that what's going on?
It will come out in the future.
It will come out at some point.
Available for watchability.
But better to be there tonight and be part of the team.
Yes, we want your Q&As.
Yeah, of course. Need those questions and answers. Okay, that's really cool. Now, Sydney, I know you as a photographer a lot of time.
Yes.
So I know we're here to talk about this cool workshop, but what's this transition? Are you still taking photos, and how
I'm
did
not.
You get into weaving, and what was that transition like for you?
It's a big evolution. I was a wedding photographer for 10 years, and Juno knows me for that. While I was a wedding photographer, I was still working full-time, so I met Lily in 2017 when I was working at Sea Alaska Heritage Institute.
Okay.
And I took a class from her during that time. And then I continued to study and just weave and weave and weave. And Lily came in one day and she's like, why are you working still? Quit your job and weave. And so in January 2020, I quit my job and was weaving full time with Lily and doing chill cat work. And then let's see, I think this is my first summer with no weddings ever.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Congratulations.
Yeah,
thank you. That's a nice transition.
Yeah.
I didn't even know you were a wedding photographer. What I knew was you would take photos for all the other, you know, awesome artists in town. Mm-hmm. And every time I saw a photo, it was always like, you know, Sydney, you know,
yeah.
It's like you were doing the photo. So that's really cool. Mm-hmm. So that is such an interesting transition. And maybe we'll talk about it a little bit too, Lily, and maybe that'll come up tonight. But how does weaving become full-time employment for you?
It really started with grants, and I wouldn't be here where I am now without those grants. Mm. I think the first one I got was with Lily that first fall in 2020. I had just had a baby, and right before I had my son, I wanted to weave a rope for him. And then my midwife said, you know what, Sydney, this baby's not going to come if you're going to try and push and get this done before this baby is born. And so I ended up weaving with Lily afterwards for, I think, 3 or 4 months with that baby on my chest, trying to get this baby rope done. And we did that with the support of the Bunnell Street Arts, and that was a really fantastic project, which then lots of people made baby robes after that. So it was a really fun kind of gateway into that. And then I received the Rasmussen, is that the Individual Artist Award?
Okay.
Native Arts and Cultures Foundation, and it's just kind of progressed since
then.
Wow,
yeah. That's amazing.
Yeah.
Was there something about... I guess this is my curiosity. Mm-hmm. What was it about the weaving that sort of, you know, got you?
I get that question a lot. It's kind of funny. I've always been really interested in textiles.
Okay.
And I, in high school, I was always hidden in my room with a sewing machine. And so I was really into making anything textile. I had aunts that are quilters, and they sew, and they knit and crochet. Everybody in my family was really into this, but none of it was really clicking. And my time at Sea Alaska Heritage Institute, when I saw somebody in the staff lounge also weaving, I was like, oh, how'd you get this? How'd you learn how to do this? And they were like, Lily sells kits. So I got that kit, and I could not stop. When I tell you I was sitting in bed weaving, and my husband was like, you have to go to sleep. Like, just, I wouldn't stop. I did it nonstop for years, and I would study.
So, Lily, are these weaving kits that you have, they're kind of like... that freebie, right? It's like the freebie to get you hooked.
I call it the gateway project. Oh, yeah. You think you're just going to weave this little keychain, and then you're like, oh, 5 years later, you're like, well, I don't sleep anymore. I don't eat. I don't pay attention to my children.
What, a baby? What's that? Exactly. Who knows what that is, right?
the nanny takes care of the baby. What?
That's so funny. Well, that's awesome, Sydney. I'm glad that you're finding that transition for yourself. That's a really cool story.
Thank
it's
you.
Just really interesting to see how people find their calling, right?
Yeah.
And at first being a photographer, but now sort of the hands-on, the textiles, that kind of thing becomes something even more tactile for you, which is really awesome. So let's talk to Jordan here. Jordan Poorman Cocker is the curator of Indigenous Arts at the Crystal Bridges Museum of American Art in Arkansas. That sounds awesome. So tell me how you and this one, our precious Lily Hope, got to be acquainted and how we came about to commissioning her to do this Chilkat robe.
Sure. First I'll say Lily Hope is an incredible artist and is known across the country for her work and mastery in weaving. I also teach at the Institute of American Indian Arts in the Masters of Fine Arts program as an artist mentor in studio art. So had the privilege of working with Lily's sister, Ursula Hudson.
Oh, yeah.
Phenomenal artist.
Yeah.
But really, this commission came about after my appointment as curator of Indigenous art at Crystal Bridges about 2 years ago. I think one of the most impactful parts of the role that I enjoy is the ability to propose new acquisitions to the collection, and that includes increasingly the capacity for commissions. So a lot of the time museum collections are made up of works that are available and made and offered by galleries, by markets, and very sort of seldomly artists themselves are offering up works, and even more seldom do the artists have chance to sort of really call some shots on what comes into these spaces. And so something that I come from a long line of artists on my mom's side were bead workers. And something that I think is really inspiring is to see the Indigenous ways of knowing and doing reflected in these public art spaces, which are so dominated by Western culture and, different hierarchical forms of knowledge, really centering art history, which excludes a lot of Native and Indigenous artists, particularly women. So for me, this commission is born out of that, really the goal to kind of highlight who we are as a country and to hand the microphone over, so to speak, to the artists who are at the forefront of revitalizing Indigenous art forms through time, and really sustaining sovereignty through those art forms. So that's a long response to a great question.
Yeah, no, it's really good. And it is interesting because I think, like, these programs and your position as curator of Indigenous arts, a lot of times what we hear in the media is, stories about how museums have items that may not belong to them, and there's the Repatriation Act, and they're trying to get items back to different cultures, different tribes, different clans in all different parts of the country. And so in this situation, it does seem, in terms of, when we're talking about sovereignty, right, in terms of like that commission between the museum and the artist, as opposed to it getting the art in a different way or in ways that aren't necessarily the coolest, right? To be able to have that that conversation and allow the artist the freedom to bring that work to the museum in that way, which I think is really cool. And I guess I'm curious about, like, when the piece is done, where does it live? Does it live at the museum? Does it belong to the museum? Is it still Lily's work? Like, what is that relationship, and how are we thinking about that in new ways today?
That's such a good question, and I'm really glad that you brought up NAGPRA, or the Native American Graves and Repatriation Act, because I think that factored into the commission agreement. So I think something that, Lily, you do incredibly well is have that sense of your agency as an artist, and when it comes to forming those agreements and really thinking about how this work lives in a collection, there are different points that I think I'd love for you to talk about within that process of finalizing this commission were really successful and hopefully offer maybe a way forward for other artists, or at least a reference point in how to work with museums. But I'll say, for me, I think museums as colonial entities are so challenging in that, you know, they are both these houses for our heritage and, you know, a lot of material culture are housed in anthropological collections or ethnographic collections. But Crystal Bridges is a very young museum, and we have a very small collection of mostly contemporary works, some works pre-1960s, but those are works on paper. So really, I think one of the opportunities that's presented with this collection is the ability to be mindful of the changes that are needed to sort of move the needle forward in the field of museums, but also I think to highlight the ways that we see Indigenous artists working with museums successfully across the world. So what we experience here in the U.S. is very distinct, but we know in Canada, New Zealand, Australia, there are these other ways of knowing and doing, and these other policies and practices within these spaces that really sort of highlights how sovereignty can be used at every part of that process. So I'll turn some time to you, Lily, to talk about
that. Yeah, Lily, I was gonna ask you, because last time you were here, we had a really deep conversation about, I guess, maybe it was around sovereignty too, it was just about sort of like, and advocating for oneself and in this work. And so, yeah, can you tell us a little bit about what your feelings are on this commission and sovereignty? I know that's what you're going to be talking about tonight. We're getting a little preview here on the radio, yeah.
One of my confessions is I understand that when I'm weaving for a museum, I'm not weaving an object. I'm weaving an educational tool. I'm weaving an ancestor that is going to become an ambassador in that space for artists, scholars, and future visitors, hopefully some of them weavers, who will go and study my work long after I'm gone. So I'm thinking about it as an incubation space of, like, this baby might be born premature, and everybody gets to come and see it as it grows into its rich life, which is unique in this commission through Crystal Bridges Museum of American Art, in that Jordan and I talked a lot about what is the life of this work. Is it really going to live in a drawer or on a mannequin on display, on, you know, sequentially offered for the public to view in Arkansas? What can we do differently? This is the second institution that has fought for bringing the Chilkat dancing blanket back to Klinkit-Ani, back to Juneau, back to Southeast Alaska, to be danced at least biannually. So celebration 2026, 2028, you know, if the robe is done by next spring, we are going to be dancing that thing in June.
Yeah.
Might be October before it's finished, but it was a sweet, it's, relationships matter.
Yeah.
Right? That we don't, as entrepreneurs, as philanthropists, as people who are generous with our hearts, we don't give money or goods or spirit to people who are, we give to people, not to entities, right? So the relationship that Jordan and I have built and the mutual love and respect in our family's relationships is what is the foundation of this exchange.
Interesting. Okay.
That We both love my sister.
Yeah.
That's fair. Sure. And just the sweetness around that, but also around shared goals of lifting up women's work mm-hmm. and bringing more equity in not just the art world, but the Native art world mm. and the Southeast Alaska Native art world, lifting up Native voices for women, Native women, the work of Native women, but also bringing Chilkat weaving onto a contemporary stage
mm-hmm.
that... Contemporary doesn't mean it's abstracted. It means it was made today,
mm.
right?
Yeah.
That's what contemporary is. I am alive right now, and you can commission this work for me. And it's going to take many hands to build it.
And the fact that you're leading this charge in a lot of ways and becoming, you know, who you've become and getting to have these opportunities, I'm sure you build in the contract, this idea of, yes, that robe must come back to Juno at least biannually, mm-hmm. whatever that is, mm-hmm. like that becomes something that you learn and then you're passing on to weavers like Sydney. And I'm just curious because I know you've had the weaving workshops and you've had other things that you've been doing recently. I'm curious what you're seeing in terms of when you were getting into this full time,
mm-hmm.
how many weavers do you think that have... you're like the Pied Piper of weaving, right? Like you're bringing along a lot of people, and you've had people come to Juno to be part of those workshops.
Mm-hmm.
And so what kind of culture are you creating? How many, are we growing the amount of weavers that are in existence? And that's a good thing, right?
Mm-hmm. It's a good thing.
Yeah.
And there is space enough for all of us.
Yeah.
For anyone who's coming along and is in the new baby steps and I don't know if I can really do this. Like Sydney was like, I'm going to jump. Mm. She had a good safety net. She's like, I'm going to go do this, honey. And her husband is like, yes, you're going to be a weaver. So that's a nice safety net there. But my Tlingit name is Wushkindendahat. It means people walking one behind another in an upward trajectory.
Mm.
I am not necessarily the leader all the time,
mm-hmm.
right? We are just all walking the same path. And it does feel like an upward climb sometimes. You know?
Yeah.
The change of gender equity or equal pay, that is a real thing. And more women's artwork in national museums, that's another real thing. So we are on an upward climb. But there's enough space for all of us weavers. Yes, when I started weaving, I think there were maybe 10 people who a museum or art collector could ask to have a Chilkat blanket made. Right now, there's almost 36.
Wow.
I taught 24 people to weave child-sized Chilkat dancing blankets, which means they hold the spiritual and technical knowledge to weave adult-sized Chilkat dancing blankets, ceremonial regalia. And that's not my credit. That's the credit to the people who wove in their beds and didn't cook dinner for a few nights in a row and put their heart and soul into the work because there's something bigger than us here.
That's amazing. And we've talked about this on the show before too, but like you mentioned when the robe will be done. These aren't just like things that you do over a weekend, right? Just for those who may not understand that these things take many hours. We've talked about this, sometimes thousands of hours to weave one of these robes. So do you have help on this robe? Who are you working with on this particular robe that's going to be at the Bridges Museum, Crystal Bridges Museum?
I have yet to name these people.
Oh.
They're already in my sphere. Like, if you are standing next to me, close to me in my sphere, I'll be like, tag, you're it, tag, you're it, tag, you're it.
Right, right. Because it takes a community, right?
Well, we did a little filming earlier today in my studio. We had a film crew come over, and they said, we want to see the robe in progress. And I was like, we're only a couple of months into this. I am literally still cooking bark and processing
right.
mountain goat hair. It's going to be 500, 600, 700, 800 hours of me and a dozen other people pulling guard hairs out of mountain goat and hiking back up the mountain to get another pound or so off of the bushes. Like, it is a volume of work that we haven't done in hundreds of years.
Wow, that's amazing. That's daunting,
mm-hmm.
is what it sounds. Because it's not like you just get the materials. You actually are making the materials. You have to get the materials and make them and forage them and
Correct.
Make them happen.
Which is part of the sovereignty.
Which is part of that, yeah. So this workshop that's happening, or this panel that's happening tonight, Weaving Sovereignty and Community. Jordan, you're going to be moderating this panel. What can we expect to hear if folks want to come down at 6 o'clock today downstairs at KTOO? What are we going to be talking about tonight?
Well, we're going to hear from the artists about their process. We're going to get a sense of not only this commission and its significance in a sort of national recollection about Indigenous art and history, but also a perspective of a vision for the future. I think I can share that this incredible work will be included in an exhibition that opens in 2027 called Made in Beauty. Mm. And that exhibition will be the first internally organized exhibit in Crystal Bridges' new reinstallation and expansion. So Crystal Bridges really aims to revolutionize the experience of coming to an art museum. And we're expanding access by adding another 114,000 square feet of new space for wow. more stories of art and learning. And so we're doing this deliberately to kind of signal to, that everyone is welcome here. So this show will feature nationally and internationally renowned Indigenous artists whose artwork has really defined transformations of art through innovative design and a diverse range of artistic mediums, including basketry, beadwork, paintings, textile, quilting, and pottery. So I think what's exciting for me about tonight's panel is that we're going to get a sense of this moment or this phase of production for Lily, and really hear from artists who are doing the work in these communities to bring what is an art form that is critical to sovereignty for this nation, you know, forward in time. Mm. And that's easier said than done. And then I think for those who are maybe even non-expert, just want to learn something about weaving as an art form, or maybe more about where this commission sort of is coming into play, I think it's also interesting for folks to get a better sense of the materials, what it means to create art that is so deeply interconnected to the land, to mm-hmm. place. So I think even for folks who may not have a deep understanding of art or maybe a deep understanding of culture, there's something for everyone when those connections to this place are really activated.
And you'll all be on the panel tonight. And then Lily, you said there's one other person who's going to be joining you?
Our third weaver is Lane Reinhardt.
Lane Reinhardt will be there tonight as well. And you can learn more about weaving and this commission and Lily's work and Sydney's work and Jordan's work at the museum out there in Arkansas, the Crystal Bridges Museum. I guess we'll look for that in 2027. It gives you a little bit of time to finish it, which is good, right? Because last time Lily was on air, she was actually working. She was actually in here doing work, which was pretty amazing because it never stops, right? It never stops. It sort of takes over your life, as you say. It becomes a way of living, right, Sydney?
Yes.
Yeah. Are you always thinking about it?
Yeah, which is really funny because Lily and I are working on a robe together right now.
Yeah.
And it left my studio yesterday, and I keep walking past my studio going, where is it? What do I do in the morning? I get up and drink my coffee and go eat, and I'm just like, past 2 days have been very off.
Wow, yeah. That's amazing.
Yeah.
Well, it's tonight at 6 o'clock at the downstairs at KTO in the big studio, the TV studio. It will be filmed for future release, but they do want a crowd to come and ask questions and be part of the team who are learning about this. It's called Weaving Sovereignty and Community. And it's Lily Hope and Sydney and Jordan and Lane. And they're all going to be there tonight at 6 o'clock. And then we'll announce, maybe we can let us know when it's going to air. And I can follow up and let people know when that's going to be airing and where it'll be airing. I'm assuming like YouTube or something will probably be where it ends up. And we'll look forward to the exhibit and hearing more about it in a couple years, I guess. That'll be... It seems
sooner
like,
than you think.
I know museums have to plan so far in advance, so it's one of those things. But really appreciate you being here. Gwyneth Cheesh for coming on today. Is there anything else that you want to say, Lily? Is there anything happening locally in town beyond the workshop tonight that you want to let people know about?
Oh, my goodness. I think Friday nights at the Zach Gordon Youth Center, the Weaving Hour Pride youth project is still in
still
progress,
happening.
Still happening, 3:30 to 6:30 p.m. on Fridays. Definitely check in with them before you send your kid over, because our weavers are traveling and fishing a lot this summer.
Yeah.
But five mentor weavers over there, and all youth and all ages are invited to go and sit and weave with them at Zach Gordon Youth Center.
And there's finally some good weather to get outside, totally, right? Which is nice. So let me get this out of the way too. Lily, where can we follow and find you?
LilyHope.com or Instagram at LilyHopeWeaver.
Sydney?
I'm at SydneyAkagi.com, or my Instagram is Roots and Rivers.
Roots and Rivers. And then where do we follow you, Jordan, and or the museum?
So the museum, you can follow along our journey online. So we have a website, Crystal Bridges. Just search Crystal Bridges in Google. And then we also have Facebook, Instagram. And if you want to follow me, I'm on Instagram, Jordan Poorman Cocker.
Awesome. Yeah. Excellent. Well, good to the cheese for being here today.
Thanks for coming down and being our witness tonight from 6 p.m. to 7 p.m. at KTOO Studios.
Love it. You're listening to Juno Afternoon on KTOO.
Support for Juno Afternoon comes from Heritage Coffee Roasting Company, providing Juno with locally roasted coffee for over 40 years, with cafes and drive-through locations throughout Juno. More at heritagecoffee.com.
From the KTOO Newsroom, I'm Mike Lane. Today is Wednesday, July 16th, and on this day in 1934, two Army observation planes were the first to land at the new Juno Emergency Landing Field on the Mendenhall Flats, 40 minutes after leaving Skagway. The pilots inspected the Juno field, which was later used by a flight of 10 Martin bombers. That's a look back at this day in 1934.
Sounds wild. Hi, I'm Riley Woodford for the Alaska Department of Fish and Game.
It's a sunny morning in the forest of interior Alaska, just south of Fairbanks. A cow moose has just given birth to twins, and the two wobbly-legged little calves are blinking in the sunlight as their mother licks them. She's wearing a radio tracking collar, and she's part of a moose research project. Late May is the peak of moose calving season in interior Alaska, and in 2020, biologists are flying and locating cows with radio collars. They're monitoring pregnant cow moose and tracking the percentage of cows giving birth and their age of first reproduction. Cows giving birth at a later age indicates nutritional stress, a sign that the population may be too large for its food source. Biologists also note the percentage of cows having twins versus single calves. More twins suggests better habitat quality and more food for those pregnant moose. In general, research indicates that moose populations with twinning rates of less than 10% are nutritionally stressed. Rates greater than 20% indicate good quality habitat that can support more moose. In this area, twinning rates averaged less than 10% from the 90s until the early 2000s. But since 2012, elevated twinning rates have been documented, suggesting that the condition of the population is improving. For Sounds Wild, I'm Riley Woodford.
From the KTOO Newsroom, I'm Mike Lane. Today is Wednesday, July 16th, and on this day in 1934, two Army observation planes were the first to land at the new Juno Emergency Landing Field on the Mendenhall Flats, 40 minutes after leaving Skagway. The pilots inspected the Juno field, which was later used by a flight of 10 Martin bombers. That's a look back at this day in 1934.
You're listening to Juno Afternoon from your public media station, KTOO. That was Mike Lane with On This Day. You can listen to Mike every morning on Morning Edition, Monday through Friday. And speaking of the news team, I have two members of them in the studio with me now. I am with KTOO Managing Editor Claire Strempel and Digital Content Director Adeline Baxter to discuss a special community barbecue happening tomorrow, Thursday, July 17th in Mendenhall Valley. Gonna cheese, Shayedi. Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to see you both in the studio. Wasayeti, how you doing, Claire?
Doing great, Boston. Getting ready for tomorrow.
And Wasayeti, Adeline, how are you?
Gonna cheese. Thank you.
Yeah. So this is a, it was postponed. You had a barbecue planned for last week, but we had some weather or something going on, and then we postponed it to this week, and it's happening tomorrow, Thursday. I saw in the freezer that there's like burgers and hot dogs and buns, and there's all kinds of stuff in the freezer here that's going to be out. Where are we having this barbecue, and when is it?
We are having this barbecue tomorrow night on Thursday from 6 to 8 at Riverside Rotary Park at the Shelter. And we will be grilling a lot of Costco's finest hamburgers, hot dogs, and vegetarian burger-shaped food objects. So that there's a little something for everyone.
There's a little something for everybody. I like that. And it's from 6 to 8, and it's Riverside Rotary Park. I did a play out there, I think. It's a really nice little park. And you're going to be – who's doing the grilling? Who's the grill master?
I'm kicking it off, but I may have to hand off at some point.
Yeah, uh-huh. We'll be swapping in and out, I think.
Swapping in and out. Mm-hmm. Are reporters known for their barbecue skills?
That will be up for you to decide.
Yeah, we have a lot of vegetarians, so at least the veggie burgers should be well cooked.
I think they're actually pre-cooked. So.
Yeah, I was going to say, I don't even know how you cook a veggie burger. So, okay, now this is also an opportunity. It's a sort of serious public conversation as well, right? We're doing this at a time when, you know, we've had some major issues in the Mendenhall Valley the last couple summers with the flooding. So is this a conversation where people can talk about that, or what is it that we're after here?
Yeah, this is supposed to be a convivial community public safety conversation. So, you know, part of it is getting out and enjoying time with your neighbors and also enjoying some solidarity with not only your neighbors who may have experienced floods before, but a place for you to bring your questions or thoughts to KTOO reporters about our coverage, what you want to know or see or hear about during the glacial outburst flood. And also we've got some city officials who are going to be out there just enjoying a burger and being a familiar face, talking to folks. So really just a moment to for everyone to kind of think about their plans and maybe talk about some things that might be worrying them, talk about what's going right, what's going wrong, and I'll be in there together.
And Adeline, I know in the last couple years we had Anna Canny who was covering those floods and did some great reporting on that. And this year you all came up with a plan for some of this reporting, right? Can you tell us a little bit about what KTOO has planned?
Right. It's been, you know, a lot of, like all sort of the entities in Juneau, we have also been trying to get better at our coverage every year as this has happened. 2023 sort of caught everyone off guard with the scale of that. And then last year, it sort of in some ways got even bigger. The aftermath of the flood was sort of even more widely felt. And so we've really spent the last few months, again, just like many other organizations in Juneau, sitting down, talking with other departments. We've got a much more robust response plan ourselves. But a big part of that is also making sure that we know what the community wants and expects of us. So in addition to, you know, the live radio coverage, even some coverage definitely on web and even some on TV, what do people want to hear from us? And already people have submitted some questions. We're going to try to answer those tomorrow night. And it's really just supposed to be sort of a back and forth, us telling them this is what we have planned, and also hopefully some of these other community entities also providing that information, and then the public telling us this is what we want and wanted to know last time around but didn't. How do we get that information to them better?
I see. Okay. And Claire, what is the expectation? Do we have a sense of like timeline of when things might happen with the glacial outbursts?
We are, there have been predictions issued by the National Weather Service. I think the latest before we stepped in here, their prediction is that it may be on August 8th, so very near the date that was the last 2 years. I think we were around August 6th for the last 2 years. So they're looking at a very similar time frame. But again, I feel like to take these very loosely because we are attempting to predict a natural disaster. So,
right, right.
And any weather conditions could change this. But I think that if we're in the newsroom, certainly we're thinking about looking at that the end of that first full week of August as a time when this could potentially happen. But I think it's important to stay tuned in and think about how weather conditions could change that. Right?
Yeah,
so don't want to put too much gravity on that one particular
right. moment. And it's important to emphasize that, you know, this event is so unlike flash floods that have been seen in other parts of the country. This isn't a flash flood in the way that it just can happen in the span of a few minutes. We do have a lot of notice with these floods from the moment when the basin starts draining. So even if it were to start draining around the 8th, as has been somewhat preliminarily predicted, it would still take up to several days for that water level to really be changing downstream. So this is like, it's like a slow burn kind of natural disaster and weirdly like predictable at the same time. And the fact that it happened almost to the day, 2 years apart, and May again, a third year. So, you know, we are keeping our eye on everything. Alex Solomon, our climate and environment reporter, is very much keeping her eye on things. And as soon as the experts tell us that, the basin is draining, you know, obviously the community is going to know about that. But then it's a matter of how quickly, how much, and what it looks like further downstream.
Right. And that's what I was going to mention is I know we had Anna Canny, but now we do have a new climate and weather reporter, Alex Solomon. She'll be reporting on this as well as probably the whole team if need be, right?
Oh, absolutely.
This will be a whole newsroom response when the flood starts happening. But your question about the timing is great because Alex is actually, we just finished editing a story right now that'll have more details on that. So, you know, stay tuned for the news. I think that'll probably be in our 4:48 newscast. And then, of course, tomorrow morning and on the web.
And, of course, then you can go tomorrow night and you can ask all kinds of questions out at Riverside Rotary Park. It's KTO Barbecue. It's sort of like a continuation of the Coffee with KTOO or what'd you guys do, Brews with the News? And now we're do we have a fancy alliteration for this one? Did we come up with something?
We have KTOO Community Barbecue.
It's a stretch,
we'll
have hamburgers.
But we'll have hamburgers, and there's going to be other awesome things. Vegetarians are welcome as well. There's going to be all kinds of good stuff out there. And it's from 6 to 8 p.m. tomorrow. That's July 17th on Thursday. And you can join us for that. That's going to be a lot of fun.
Mm-hmm.
Is there anything else from the news team that we should be looking forward to? Anything cool coming up that you want to let the people know about before we take off?
I guess we'll just slightly tease that we do have a series coming up that was the brainchild of Anna Canny, our former climate and environment reporter, and that has passed the torch to Alex Solomon and the rest of the newsroom. So we'll be really diving into the science and the human element and response all around the glacial outburst floods in Juneau. So if you want to take a deep dive into some ice cold water,
figuratively speaking.
Yeah, I love that. Awesome. Well, Claire Strempel, managing editor, and Adeline Baxter, digital content director here at KTO. Cheese for telling us a little bit about this, and have fun at the barbecue tomorrow.
Thanks so much, Boston.
This is Juno Afternoon on KTOO. We're going to take a listen to Josh Fortenberry's new single called City Lights. This is from his forthcoming album. This is Juno Afternoon. We'll be back to talk with another KTO reporter, Clarice Larson, about the candidate filing opening up for the municipal elections. Exciting stuff. Here's City Lights from Josh Fortenberry.
By so quickly now, and soon they'll all be gone, one by one. Still I have said nothing, and I'm growing afraid. Slip away.
This is Juno Afternoon on your community-supported media station, public media station, KTOO. I'm your host, Boston Christopher. That was a little Josh Fortenberry, his new single, City Lights. There's also a video for it, which is really cool, like the way it was filmed and stuff. You can find that on his Instagram, Josh Fortenberry, with one R in the berry at the end. So I am now with Clarice Larson, who is going to tell us about politics. Like, if you're interested in getting involved in local politics, well, the candidate filing opens this week on Friday, and Clarice is here to tell us a little bit about what's available and how you might get involved if you so choose to do so. How are you doing today, Clarice?
I'm good. I know this is such an invigorating topic to talk about on air, but I'm really excited for this year's election. We've got some spicy stuff.
Well, there's people who are interested. We've had on the folks from the city and stuff who talk about the how to run for local election. You can go back and listen to that in the archives on Juno Afternoon. They tell you about, they hold a workshop every spring, early summer, where they tell you, like, here's what you need to do. And it's not just for people who might be interested in running, but it's for people who might be wanting to manage a campaign or help somebody else run, or, you know, getting involved in local politics is important, and it's not that hard to do, and it doesn't have to be crazy expensive either, which is another thing I think people think that they can't get involved with. But there's two basically things that happen with the municipal election, right? There's the assembly and there's the school board. So the filing opens this Friday, and people have, what, a couple of weeks?
Yeah, they have until, I think, Monday the 28th at 4:30 p.m. to put their name in the running.
In the hat, as it were. Mm-hmm. And so what's available? Let's talk about the assembly first. What's happening assembly-wise?
Yeah, there are three seats opening up, which is really exciting. We have Ella Atkinson, Greg Smith, and Wade Bryson all around the assembly, and they're going to have their seats open up. I spoke to, or I texted all of them a couple months ago saying, hey, are you running for assembly again? And all of them said yes, so they're going to be running for re-election. So, yeah, people can still run for those seats, but they're going to face the incumbents.
Wade has been on the assembly for a couple of terms now, at least.
Yes.
And I think Greg is in his, like, third, maybe, going for
his
third term?
Yeah, Greg and Wade are finishing up their second term.
Okay.
And they're going into their third. They both, all assembly members, they can only run three-year terms. That's, like, the max.
Okay. And then Ella was the newest one, right? Recent?
Yeah, she actually, hers was a little weird because she was elected to fill the remaining 2 years of Carol Treem, who resigned. So she actually hasn't done a full term yet.
Okay, so this is her first sort of actual election, really, right?
I mean, she ran against Paul Kelly in a normal election.
Okay.
Paul Kelly got the full 3 year seat. She got the 2 year seat.
I see.
That was 2 years ago.
Yeah. That's right. Yeah. They happen so frequently. It's hard to remember sometimes.
Like, I'm getting old.
But it doesn't mean that you can't run if you want to, right? Like, mm-hmm. just because there are incumbents, and that sometimes puts people off. Like, open seat sounds easier to get in. But if you don't necessarily agree with what's going on with those three seats or with what their voting history has been or whatever that might be, you can challenge for those seats. Now, are they running in specific – it's all the specific districts, right?
Yeah, but I think at the end of the day, everyone gets to – Vote for everyone.
Wherever. You just have
But they're on districts. I know that I can't remember off the top of my head, but you vote for all of them, essentially.
Yeah,
it doesn't matter where you live.
Right, okay. But where you live dictates which seat you might be able to run for.
Exactly, yeah.
District 1, 2, or the assembly-wide.
Yeah, so I would say if you're going to run, just check in with which seats you want to run for and if you qualify for that.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, now we know that the school board over the last year and a half has had some turmoil. Let's just say that, turmoil.
Yeah.
What's going on with the school board seats?
Yeah, so there's three seats open, and it's kind of similar to what we're seeing at the assembly. There's two full seats that are going to be open to be filled, and then one partial seat. The two full seats are for D.D. Sorensen and Emil Mackey. Both of them, again, I texted God knows how many months ago, and they said they're both running for re-election. That partial seat is to fill Will Muldoon's seat. He resigned abruptly a few months ago. We don't know why, but his seat's temporarily filled by Steve Whitney, and that will be opening up.
I see. Okay. Yeah, I remember when we got that sudden news, and so no follow-up on that? He never explained why he was...
We definitely tried, but he didn't tell us anything.
He declined. Public comment.
Respectfully declined, yeah.
Yeah, I understand that. Okay. And then, so that's the school board. And do you have to have a student in school to run for the school board?
No. In fact, D.D. Sorensen is just a retired teacher. She doesn't have any kids in the school district. And we were actually, our education reporter and I were trying to figure that out today. We were like, who has kids? And a good portion of them do. I think it helps give perspective to the members, but you can be, you know, Joe Schmo and show up.
You can be a community member who's interested, like Dee Dee, who is a retired teacher, worked in education, and still wants to be involved.
Yeah.
That's kind of cool. And so there's three seats there. And I don't know, do you think there's a difference between like the difficulty of running for school board versus assembly? What's your take on that?
I think that a lot of people tend to run for the assembly more because it's very it can be very spicy, it can be very action-packed. There's a lot of real change that can happen at the assembly municipal-wide, but I think school board people kind of sleep on it because there's a lot of action that the school board does that can really change the community and the youth that we have here. So I would say assemblies tends to be more popular for people to run in, but school board definitely has some good candidates usually each year.
The school board has been spicy the last couple years, just in terms of the decisions they've had to make, the impact that those decisions have had, like just all of that.
And if you keep following Jamie Deep's reporting, like it's only going to get spicier. So,
yeah, wow. Yeah. Now, in addition to, so those are the seats that are available. So there's three assembly seats and three school board seats. And then we also, now these aren't necessarily things people have to file for with this filing, candidate filing opening on Friday. Again, it opens on Friday, runs for a couple weeks. So if you're interested, you can go to the municipal election website and find out more about how to do that process. But just as a preview, because I know we'll have our awesome coverage that we do in the fall that the news team does on the elections. There'll probably be candidate forums and all that good stuff. But there's some interesting potential measures, right? Ballot measures. Do you want to talk about a little bit about what you're seeing and hearing?
Yeah. Each spring, you know, citizens are able to, you know, try to get signatures to put something on the ballot. This year we saw a handful try to get on the ballot, but only two actually got enough signatures and were certified to get on the ballot. We have two that are kind of based on the financial stuff. Basically, voters are going to be asked whether to place a limit on the city's property tax rate and then also remove local sales tax on food and utilities. So those are citizen initiatives. And then we have stuff at the Juno Assembly level. So the Assembly can actually say, hey, we have some ideas that we want to put to voters. And some of those that are not final yet, they're still have a few weeks to figure it out. But we've got bond measures on funding repairs to the schools and city's water and sewer system. And then a potential new seasonal sales tax.
A new seasonal sales tax?
Yes.
What would that be about?
Well, it's a little messy right now because they're kind of in the throes of figuring it out. But the idea is they would increase the sales tax in the summertime to capitalize on the, you know, 1.7 million tourists we get each summer. And then they would lower it in the wintertime for residents when we don't see as much tourists. And the idea originally was to do that to be able to pay to take pay to remove local sales tax on food and utilities. But since there's the that ballot measure already doing that, they're already trying to ask that question, the Assembly took that part out of the... It's really messy. It's really messy, but there's a lot of things in play right now, and I am really excited to see how they all turn out.
Well, it'll be really interesting to follow the coverage. Clarice Larson, city reporter, covers all this stuff. You've got a couple exciting months ahead as it all sort of washes out in the storm, as they say, or whatnot, and we'll look forward to following your coverage. You can follow more of Clarice's coverage at kto.org for all things politics and Assembly and everything going on, right?
Yeah, it's my favorite time of the year. I love September, October.
I love that. Well, thank you so much, Clarice, for coming in and giving us a little bit of a preview. If you're interested again in being a candidate in the municipal elections this fall, the filing period opens this Friday.
Yes, I'll be there, 8 a.m.
You can say hi to Clarice. This is KTOO Juno Afternoon. We'll be right back.
This is Bird Note. To us humans, flooding can often seem like an unmitigated catastrophe. In the right circumstances, though, when it's predictable and wildlife is well adapted, flooding can create a biological bonanza. In the Amazon River Basin, annual heavy rains can raise water levels 30 to 40 feet in just days. The basin is almost flat, sloping just 1 inch per mile over its eastward flow to the Atlantic, a journey of some 2,000 miles. So when the rain arrives, forests flood, and a massive push of sediment erects new islands almost overnight. It's a lush world that scientists and nature travelers explore by boat, where some of the world's most iconic birds find fruit in the trees or perch at the water's edge. Toucans and macaws, tiny pygmy kingfishers, tiger herons, and massive ringed kingfishers. Orapendulas sing a startling refrain. These birds are part of the richest array of life on Earth, an extraordinary mosaic of habitats, all intricately linked, and all dependent on the river system that holds 1/5 of all the world's fresh water. For Bird Note, I'm Mary McCann. Bird Note gives you the sounds of birds every day, and you get the sights as well when you follow us on Instagram at Bird Note Radio.
Well, that's going to do it for today's Juno Afternoon. It is good to be back in the Alaskan summer, all these beautiful days. On tomorrow's show, Moms Unhinged, the comedy show, is coming to Juno. We chat with a couple of the comics. Plus, we meet the new provost of the University of Alaska Southeast. Juno Afternoon airs Wednesday through Friday at 3 p.m. right here on KTOO Juno 104.3 and KAUK Juno Auk Bay 91.7. Hello, out the road. Find the show online at ktoo.org/JunoAfternoon, where you can listen to episodes, subscribe to the podcast, offer feedback or suggestions, or find out how to be a guest on the show. You can also find live stream archives on KTOO's YouTube page. Our theme music is by Indian Agent. Programming support for Juno Afternoon comes from listeners and viewers like you and Alaska Airlines Club 49, Hanson Gress, and Heritage Coffee Roasting Company. Juno Afternoon is a project of the KTOO Arts and Culture team. I'm Boston Christopher, producer and host of the program, with help today from Lisa Purvis. Gonna cheese. Have a wonderful Juno evening.
Thank you.